From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 30th day of November 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Eric Snodgrass will be here too from Agrible to take a look at the weather forecast, not only here in the United States, where he expects cold and that wintry weather out west, rain here, and maybe a warm-up next week for us, but also some really good conditions in South America. We'll take that up with Eric a bit later in the program. And as we close out our time together, we'll discuss the agricultural news for the day and hear from yesterday's Van Trump conference in Kansas City, where we recorded Commodity Week. If you can stay with us for the whole hour, you'll hear all of that program. Otherwise, a snippet of it. And we begin with the CEO of Bunge Global. His name is Soren Schroeder. You'll want to stay with us if you can all the way through, or pick it up online at willag.org for this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Mike Zuzlo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Hey, good afternoon to you, Mike. Thanks for being with us for the day, and happy Friday.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Happy Friday to you, too.
Hey, you know, pretty good Friday, actually, in Chicago. Grains were higher, corn up 4 to 6 cents, soybeans up 7 to 6, and lead option December wheat up 19 and a quarter. Anything that prospered that one along?
Yeah, a couple things, and it's been quite a while. I might have been a different age when we had a 4% rally in one day in wheat, so we're going to have to go back and look at that. I might have been in my late 40s or something like that. It's been so long, or at least it feels like it. Two things. Deliveries were zero in both hard red wheat and soft red wheat. And I always look at that in times like this, Todd, because when you have a big supply mindset, if the Chicago Board of Trade price is considered cheap, then sellers at delivery who have the authority or the option to make the decision of letting go of their bushels into the Board of Trade system would probably go after the Board of Trade price if it wasn't cheap. And so when you have zero deliveries, it kind of suggests to me that you have a cheap price at the board in relation to the cash market. And I think that was one thing that followed on. I think an even bigger, more important feature was USDA coming out yesterday and their updated ag forecast. Last one we'd had was in August. They took the wheat exports for this marketing year from about 28 million tons up to 30.5 million. That was a 9.3% increase. And it really suggests that maybe Egypt's purchase this week is one of several, and it's some more is going to come. I've also been hearing that Argentina's harvest, post-harvest wrap-up in the wheat has not been as good as they originally thought. So really nice to see the wheat as the leader as we go into this G20 meeting and have a lot of volatility and fear, quite honestly, just fear in the soybean market right now.
So fear in the soybean market. However, corn and soybeans managed to rally. Was that positioning evening before we got into the G20 on the weekend?
Yeah, I think two things there. I think the harvest progress numbers from Monday really came back around this week at the end of the week, because we're looking at another big snowstorm in the West. Key states like Nebraska, who are only 84% harvested in corn. Key states like Missouri look like they're going to get a lot of rain this weekend and next week, are only 85% harvested in soybeans. You've got enough beans and corn left out in the field. I think that really helped. We had light deliveries in the corn as well. I think the other thing, too, is I just feel as though maybe the trade is already pricing in good news coming out of the G20. We made that 830 low for a monthly low this week or this month, around 832. 897.5 was our high made for the month. I think it was last week we did that. We weren't able to quite take that out, but we've gotten up to that 896 level. So we've been able to come about 60 cents off the lows. I do think it's mainly because of the harvest progress in beans and expectations that we will at least freeze or come to a truce between the United States and China when it comes to the tariffs. We won't go from 10% to 25% in January. That's probably the biggest thing to watch as we come back from the weekend.
If that happens, do we get a spike more than we already have in the soybeans?
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, I think this is one of those markets where you have the technicals on your side. 906, we haven't been above since June. So if you get good news out of the Trump truce And you had a Fed truce earlier this week where the Federal Reserve said they're not going to be looking at preset conditions in terms of rate hikes in 19. I think that's friendly. So if you get those two things working together, you see a high in the dollar and a low in the Chinese currency, you go through 906. I think you can go all the way up to 935, 937. That'd be about a dollar rally, and it'd be right up against that 52-week moving average. So that'd be my target points for getting some hedges in place in the soy.
And that makes sense for the current crop year and next year both? I mean, given the amount of carryout that's available?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm taking about 1 million acres off of harvested acres because of the harvest progress numbers. I'm taking another 0.6 of a bushel off USDA's yield. So I'm going to be coming in around an 860, 850, 865 carryover. That would suggest that that would be the top end as well, or close to the top end without true weather problems in another 30, 60 days in South America for the new crop. So 950, 955 and Nov beans, I think, is a good target to lay in some more insured bushel hedges, depending on where you're at.
So you're ready next week on both crops then?
Yeah, really. Both crop years. Yes, that's
yes.
Right. And I would even say that, you know, you get up around 410, 415 in Dees corn. You don't want to turn away. I haven't sold anything in 19 corn yet, so I'm kind of eager to get started. I do think the fundamentals, though, in the corn are just so strong because we're, what, 80% above last year on corn exports, and ethanol made a 10-year low this week. So how much worse could ethanol get, especially with the EPA starting to move a little bit more in the direction of the biofuel mandate and easing up some constraints?
What about the outside markets? Still $50 crude oil at this point.
Yeah, and it doesn't bother me, honestly, because all of the updated GDP forecasts, I'm getting ready to do a, you know, marketing meetings like a lot of people and outlook meetings for 19. And a lot of IMF, WTO, those people, even USDA, you know, worried about $60, $70, $80 crude oil and put that into their GDP numbers. So for an oil importer like China to have $50 crude oil, West Texas and $60 in Brent, that's pretty good news. So I think this is a good sweet spot for the crude oil. And if I'm right about the truces and we get a dollar high, that should bring the crude around in terms of fund investment. And that's what I'll really be looking at Monday, is that dollar high and a Chinese currency low, because we're right up against the highs from, the lows from last month and the Chinese currency. That was the same levels that they had gotten to back in 2008.
And this would lift open the top end then for corn?
I think it would, because I think the emerging market currencies would be looked upon as generally strong. You'd see flows go, I think, into the emerging markets at the expense of the U.S., and that's where the commodity investment cycle would be more pro-cyclical to get some commodities underneath them. And that's one thing I'll be talking about in the weekend copy is the gold market. I think gold's getting pretty close to a pretty serious buy at this point for a hedger, inflationary type of person.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, U.S., Mexican, and Canadian leaders today signed the new USMCA trade agreement prior to the start of the G20 summit in Argentina. Rod Bain has more from the United States Department of Agriculture.
The USMCA is the largest, most significant, modern, and balanced trade agreement in history.
The agreement expresses the shared will by our three nations to work together towards the well-being and prosperity of each one of our societies.
And the benefits of trade must be broadly and fairly shared. That is what modernizing NAFTA achieves, and that is why it was always so important to get this new agreement done right.
The leaders of the North American nations Friday, U.S. President Donald Trump, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto via translator on his last day in office, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau speaking prior to the signing of the new USMCA trade agreement.
Hey, thank you very much, everybody.
The signing in Buenos Aires, Argentina is the latest step towards advancing this agreement to implementation. Legislative bodies for all three nations must still ratify the USMCA before it takes effect. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The University of Illinois FarmDoc Daily team detailed what's different in the new USMCA as compared to the NAFTA agreement it could replace. That if it's approved by the United States Congress, something that probably won't happen until maybe late next year, USMCA does not change the old tariff structure or the zero tariff policies on most manufacturing or agricultural goods. There are large sections of the old NAFTA which were just not touched, and the most significant changes, including digital trade, were already negotiated as part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. The Trump administration withdrew from it, but USDA officials have been signaling this trilateral trade agreement, which adopts some of the TPP language, could pave the way to rejoining that effort to restrain China's influence in East Asia. Now, USMCA requires 75% of car parts to be manufactured in one of the three signatory countries to be exempt from tariffs. That's up from 62.5%. 45% of the car parts must be made by employees making at least $16 an hour, and Mexican laborers will now have the right to unionize. It also extends labor protections to migrant workers and protects women from discrimination. The minimum wage is not binding in Canada or the United States, and it does not take effect in Mexico until 2023. And finally, Canada has agreed to open 4% of its dairy market to farmers in the United States. And finally today, the U.S. EPA today updated the RVOs, or renewable volume obligations, for biofuels in the nation's energy supply for 2019. On paper, those look pretty standard. However, the Renewable Fuels Association CEO Jeff Cooper says the EPA must prove it will enforce the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard. He says the reasons we're concerned about this is that we've seen here in the past few years the numbers published by EPA end up not being real, because they're undermined by the small refinery exemptions. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You know, earlier this week, I had the pleasure of hosting several panels at the Van Trump Conference, and there were 1,000 in attendance there in Kansas City. Kevin was kind enough to allow me to record Commodity Week from the stage in front of that crowd and to include some of the folks that he had invited along for his conference. Matt Bennett of Bennett Consulting, Mike Mock at Mike Mock Consulting, and Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri-Marketing, along with Kevin Van Trump of the Van Trump Report, and Soren Schroeder, the CEO of Bunge Global, joined me for Commodity Week. Here's a portion of that program, and you'll hear it all if you can stay with us for the full hour. It's up online at willag.org already. I started by asking Mr. Schroeder from Bunge if he thought that the soybean market had been changed in terms of global flow by the trade and tariff situation currently taking place.
Beans are going to $15.
You made everybody happy. Yeah.
That's it. That's all we need to know. Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Well, you know, everything in this world is so random. So, you know, I'm I don't have to be an expert, but I can tell you that how this year has evolved has been incredible. If you go back to May, June this year, nobody would have thought that China was able to navigate through a tariff situation as we've had it without eventually tapping back into U.S. supplies. And as it turns out, it's happened. We will sail into January, February of this year and be back in South America, and there'll be another year that goes by before they would have to come back to the U.S. So many articles were written over the summer about the impossibility of that happening, that demand was so great it couldn't adjust. It did. Markets work. And in China, there's an invisible hand of sorts that may not be so invisible that has pushed demand in a direction where they're now managing to get through an otherwise impossible situation. So it's been an incredible year with gigantic shift to South America. Of course, we've all felt the opposite side of that in the United States, with the resulting mounting carry out in soybeans, and why everybody yesterday said that beans could go to below $8. I actually don't think so, but they also won't go to 15. I don't think it's permanent. I do believe there will be a resolution to this, But obviously, agriculture is not the big issue, and that's the deal. There's a lot more at stake than that. And so in a way, U.S. ag in particular is kind of caught in the middle of this big other debate of power, most of which is around intellectual property. And how do you put a price on that? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But I do believe that there will be a resolution. But I don't think it'll be in time to make a big difference in soybeans for the current crop year. And then it's really all about what signals we send to the market for the acreage that will be planted in April, May. And I don't know what that outcome will be. But I think there'll be a resolution, and I think things will get back to some kind of normal. But it'll take a crop cycle or so, maybe two, to get on the other side of the hangover that's been created by this. That's just a fact. And in the meantime, we all have to make the best of it. So maybe later we can come back to all the other discussions we've had over the last day or so about differentiation and decommoditizing and all that. I got some views on that as well.
Oh, I'd love to. But we'll do anyways, that. That's, Matt Bennett, he just told us this is a done deal, that China doesn't need the United States this year. That's new information.
Well, I think basically we've seen that kind of play out. Most people said by October they were going to be back in buying soybeans and crickets. You know, it just didn't happen. We're still waiting on this. With them getting a crop in the ground in Brazil in a timely fashion, yes, they've had a lot of rain, but there's a very good opportunity that they're going to be coming on online. It's quite likely earlier than what they have the last 2 years, whenever they've been pushed back on planting a little bit. So are the Chinese going to need to buy U.S. soybeans? If they do, it's going to probably be through a back channel effort, and I don't think it'll be widely publicized. As I said yesterday, I think there's growing pressure for Trump, especially with this week has been kind of a bad news week for him with the GM layoffs. I know he's been very frustrated with that. There is growing pressure, in my opinion, for him to come out of here with some sort of positive news. Now, I'm not saying they're going to have an agreement, but at least some sort of a ceasefire, if you will, maybe not increasing his tariffs. But in my opinion, as a producer, you don't want to get too wrapped up in all of this. Like Mike was saying yesterday, can you make money at $8 beans if that's where you're at, given, you know, the additional subsidy? Hopefully we're going to, I mean, I didn't ask for the subsidy. I'm a producer as well. But let's face it, without the subsidy, we were looking at a pretty grim situation in a lot of parts of the Corn Belt this year. If you get the additional subsidy, it's definitely going to help stave off some situations that could be quite unfortunate this year. And by all means, you got to add those into the price of beans and make your decision on what you're going to do. The tougher situation is 2019 beans, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mike Mock, today, over the weekend, Monday, if there's something that comes out from the Trump and Xi meeting in Buenos Aires, there is a bump, there has been a bump this week. Do farmers need to take advantage of it? They've been holding off. They've truly held off on the idea that this is going to be resolved.
That does concern me. It rings a lot of hope, and hope is never a good trading strategy. I think the farmers got off to the start of this year in very good shape, very typical 30, 40, 50% of the crop price, you know, north of $10, a lot of $10 cash being sold, and then nothing. And since then, as Matt just alluded to, not only did we get this subsidy, but we also got record yields in some areas by wide margins. So I want to continue to focus on, focusing on the revenue and taking it to the bank in this kind of environment.
That's Mike Mock with Mike Mock Consulting. He joined me at the Van Trump Conference earlier this week up on stage, along with Matt Bennett of Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds, Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri Marketing, of course, Kevin Van Trump, and Soren Schroeder, the CEO of Bungie Global, for our recording of Commodity Week. You can find the whole of that program online right now at WILLAG.org. You're listening to the Closing Market Report for this Friday afternoon. It's the 30th day of November. We're joined by Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. Eric, good afternoon to you. Thanks for being with us. Let's start with the winter storm that's supposed to be trekking its way across the Midwest. How bad is this one?
You know, it's pretty rough. It's going to be really bad, I think, in parts of parts of Nebraska and South Dakota, parts of Iowa, Minnesota. That's going to be on the backside of this big low pressure system. This is the one that started off about a day and a half ago, came on shore in California, causing a lot of flooding problems, but certainly packed in a bunch of snow in the mountains out west. So as it comes through, I think here's the major things I'm watching. You know, we're certainly worried about maybe a foot plus of snow in parts of Nebraska. So this is going to be a major, and a second big blizzard for that region. But around here, rain's going to be starting very, very late tonight, probably more like early tomorrow morning. And it's going to be coming out of the south. So our temperatures are really going to rebound. We're going to see 60 degrees tomorrow, but it's going to be extremely wet. I'm expecting across the state of Illinois anywhere between 1 to 2 inches of rain, depending on your location. Now, the severe weather threat today is down south. So it's in Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, parts of eastern Oklahoma. And tomorrow, we do have the chances as this comes through. It might come through in three big rounds of rainfall that we could be dealing with the potential for some severe storms around here as well, especially to the south of us in Illinois. So that's that first system. And I'll tell you, behind it, we've got cold air that comes in again. And that cold air may be locked in possibly through around the 8th, 9th, 10th of November. And we'll even see another potentially big winter storm sometime around the 6th through the 8th of December. So, we got cold air locked in through the 10th day of December here coming up.
Anything for the middle of December that we can look forward to?
Yeah, you know, we've been watching the development of a couple of things. There are some global circulations that we pay attention to that give us a clue about the longer-term weather. And the names, here's a couple of names. We have the Madden-Julian Oscillation, the Arctic Oscillation, and another one called the Pacific North America Pattern. And basically all three of those are coming together such that the polar vortex is strengthening. That keeps the cold air locked away up in the North Pole. We have the Madden-Julian Oscillation going toward its warmer phases for the United States, and we're going to be seeing a deep trough developing in the Gulf of Alaska. And as a result of that, starting maybe around the 10th, maybe lasting all the way to the 15th, we're going to get some reprieve from this much, much colder than average weather. So it's kind of like a mid-month, call it a warm-up, but really it's going to be a return more toward normal with maybe a slight warm bias. And the big questions that all of us meteorologists are trying to answer is, what's the longevity? How long is that going to last? So we start looking at some analog years for the rest of winter. You know, that's maybe the real big question here. Good analog years might be 2002, 2003, that winter, or the winter of 2014-15. And they all had kind of moderated Decembers, but big colder outbreaks that came again in January and February. So this by no means is me saying winter is over. But I will tell you this, one of the big features we watched that kind of has a correlation to our winter pattern is El Nino. And right now, the Kelvin wave that's been kind of progressing, below the ocean surface, and will be surfacing with some warm water across the equatorial Pacific, looks as though it'll be reaching a peak here in the coming weeks. And that actually makes a lot of sense because El Nino is actually named after Jesus, it's because El Nino's typically reach a peak around his birthday. And so this is falling in nicely with what the science would tell us.
Wow, that's kind of a neat little tidbit. Thank you for that one. Yeah. Hey, turn your attention to South America. They got to a really good start, especially, I think, in Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil, the monsoon arrived on time. We had good, timely precipitation early in the season, so the crop went in. And so far, you're hard-pressed to look across Brazil and find an area that's been stressed. We are looking very wet in northern Brazil. While the MJO I just mentioned goes into these phases that are warm for North America, they're typically wet for northern parts of South America. So they're going to be wet over the coming weeks. But people at this point, it's hard to say whether or not that's going to be detrimental. It will be a little drier in southern Brazil, but this is a region that is already doing just fine on its soil moisture. So we're not seeing too much of a stress in the short term for Brazil. And I think the bigger translation there is, what does this mean for the safrinha crop, that corn and cotton crop that comes second? Because they got everything in on time, I think that it means that the chances of that second crop also going in on time, which gives it its best chance for high yields, is likely as well. But the only place that's been a little stressed would be Argentina. They've had a lot of severe weather. It's been localized, so there's been localized flooding. and it's kind of delayed the planting progress down there and caused some issues with replanting. But still, the bigger elephant in the room is the fact that Brazil has really gotten off to a great start. So we'll have to monitor very closely to see if any stresses emerge once we get into January and February, especially for that first crop beans. So at this point, there's nothing that we can point at and say, wow, the disaster is coming. We just don't see it yet.
Hey, you have a great weekend.
I will. You too.
That, of course, is Eric Snodgrass. He is with Agrible. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.